Nessa.
Mujeres feministas.
Yon femini. Un femactivist.
Nari mukti.
Matapang na babae. Kechi mai ka ishk.
Ago in a galaxy far, far away.
What are little boys made of? Snips and snails and puppy dog tails. That's what little boys are made of. What are little girls made of? Sugar and spice and all things nice. That's what little girls are made of.
Look up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's
Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman.
Now the world is ready for you.
Your chains, crack your cage apart. I can't tear your walls down with the beating of my heart.
Welcome to part one of the two-part series, Engendered Opinions. Or, excuse me, are you a girl or a boy?
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might, that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he loves also the bow that is stable.
Hi, my name is Dripti Kamath and I live in Foster City, California. I have two daughters, Mira and Zai. They're 6 and 10 years old.
My name is Zai Shah. I am 10 years old and I also live in Foster City, California with my mom and dad.
My name is Abhijit Shah. I'm the father of these two kids.
My name is Mira.
When they were in preschool, around 3 years old, that's when both of them started asking questions about what's a boy and what's a girl. I didn't really have to explain much to them because in their preschool, the teachers were very open about boys and girls and, you know, the parts of the body of the boy and parts of the body of the girl. And in fact, I remember when Zai was 3 and I was driving home from preschool and she said, Baba is a boy and you're a girl. And I said, I know that, but how do you know that? She said, oh, because Baba has a penis and you have a vagina. And I thought I was going to crash the car into like the side of the freeway. And I'm like, yeah. And I didn't want to make a big deal about it, but I was freaking out. I'm like, why are they saying that? But then I called my friend and she said, it's better that they use these words and just as matter of factly say it rather than calling it, you know, teeny, weeny, weeny, whatever it is, because then that's not healthy. And so I'm like, okay, that's fine. I guess I still can't say the word without cringing. That's the way I was brought up. We never use these words, but I guess it's okay now.
Well, I choose my own clothing and my own hair because I'm very picky about my clothes and I can't really trust my parents to pick what I want to wear. So I always choose my own clothes. Same with my hair style.
You help with your mom too.
Yeah, I do help my mom and my dad sometimes choose their clothing, but they never help me choose mine.
Mira, what about you? Who chooses your clothes?
Mommy and Daddy.
Yep, I choose her clothes, mostly because we want to make sure she's dressed appropriately for the weather. I mean, she has clothes that she likes to wear that I don't mind. I like it. It's not about the type of clothes. It's about being warm, you know, wearing a little vest inside. And then it's always windy in Foster City because we live by the bay. And I just want to make sure she's warm.
But like at the store, she chooses her own clothes. It's just that in the morning, you decide what she has to wear.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah. She chooses for buying the clothes. I never buy my kids clothes because then they'll be like, nope, I'm not wearing it. And that's the end of story. I can never make them wear it. So when I buy the clothes, I take them with me and they just pick their own clothes and I just buy what they pick. They're up in the playground all the time. And, you know, I prefer that they wear leggings and pants so that it's easier for them to play. Zai likes to wear more, like she used to wear more skirts and stuff when she was growing up, you know, little dresses and things, but she would always wear pants under just for the convenience of being in school. Mira likes to wear dresses sometimes when we go for like the father-daughter dance at school or those kind of events, but most of the time Mira prefers to just wear leggings or pants and a t-shirt. She's most comfortable in that, but she's also more acrobatic than Zai, and she's like jumping around and doing cartwheels, just even walking to the grocery store. So it's better that she's in those kinds of clothes.
Even though the clothes are pants and unisex clothes, but they're in different sections of the store. I mean, they're different colors and different patterns. So the boys' pants and the girls' pants are different.
One thing I don't like about the stores here, because if you know, Mira really likes superheroes and she wants to wear clothes that have superheroes, you know, things on them. Very rarely in the girls section, you'll find those. You won't find like a Spider-Man dress or you won't find like a dress that has, you know, Iron Man on it. You have to go to the boys section. And I'm like, why can't girls also like Spider-Man? Why do we have to go to the boys section to buy it? And so then I go to the boys section to buy these things for Mira. But I would love to have a place where, you know, these superheroes are in both sides, like not necessarily only in the boys section. And actually, to that point, Zai had a friend and he loved wearing, you know, things that had princesses on it. He was only 3 years old. He was a boy. And his mom said that she could never find, of course, she wouldn't find anything with like a princess picture on a boys in the boys section. And if she came to the girls section, all the princess things were very pink and frilly. And he didn't like the frills and stuff. He just liked the princess. So then she went and got like a thing that you can iron on to the t-shirt. So she would get a princess decal that you iron on to the you know, his clothes. So he would have a blue sweatshirt with a car on one end, which is, you know, part of the shirt, and then a little princess head on the other side. Yep, that she would iron on.
My name is Zai Xia. I am 10 years old. My favorite color is turquoise or aqua or around that shade. I'm not really sure what I want to be. I really like the subject math, so I want to have a job like computer engineering or something that involves math in it. I'm not sure I really have a creative side. I mean, like, I like doing arts and crafts and stuff, but I'm not sure I want that as a job. I'm not sure I really like, I mean, it's fun to design things, but I'm not sure I really want that for a career.
Do you play with boys?
Well, I play with my cousins, but at my school, people don't really like interact with the other gender. So I don't really play with boys as often as I do at home. So no, I don't play with boys that often. It just naturally happens. My school encourages like different genders interacting with each other. It's just that people in my school think that the other gender has cooties or whatever. So it's not really that, you know, we don't really interact with each other that often. My favorite sport is soccer. Really like playing soccer. I actually only started last year, but it's like a fun sport for me to play.
Zai, you have a person in is it the next Miss Thompson's class that has like longish hair? And one time even I asked you, is that a girl or a boy? So how do your friends interact with that? Is it first of all, is that a boy or a girl?
That is a boy.
Okay.
And mostly everyone just acts like he's a boy and that's normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it is because it's not really a question, like, if you have long hair, a lot of people have long hair, mm-hmm. that doesn't necessarily mean that's a boy or a girl. A lot mm-hmm. of girls have really short hair, mm-hmm. like, I had really short hair at one point at time. So people just, like, treat him as a normal person.
Okay.
Not necessarily as awkward or weird.
Okay.
If you wear pink a lot, they mm-hmm. say, oh, she's a girly girl, mm-hmm. or she's a tomboy.
And do they have similar names for boys? Or like, oh, he's such a macho boy, or like he's such a girly boy. No, it's only for the girls.
Yeah, I mean, like, they don't necessarily call boys girly or not. They just say they're a boy, she's a tomboy, she's a girly girl.
So. Okay. I think the area that we live in Foster City, it's more traditional. I think the people who kind of just come here, they're more conservative and more traditional. So, you know, if the kid was one gender and said that, hey, I think I'm another gender, I think there would be a lot of pressure to like conform to the gender that you were born into in this era that we live in, because it's more traditional in a way, more conservative. That's what I think. I think things are changing, and I hope like my family will be a pioneer in changing that if that happens to us, because I'm very open and more liberal that way. But I can see the parents of my kids' friends, I can see them trying to force their kid to conform into the gender that they were born in. I don't think there's any pushback about girls being better than boys in the, you know, in running and stuff. Mira is the fastest girl in her class, and she's known for that. In fact, all the boys tell their dads, and the dads tell me, oh, you're Mira's mom. My son told me Mira is the fastest girl or the fastest person in the class. And they really, they're proud of that, and they appreciate it. So it's not like, oh, she's a girl, how can she be fast? They just say, oh, my son told me Mira is the fastest person in the class. So, and Mira really enjoys having that title of being the fastest runner in class.
Okay, I'm Shelley Romalis. I am Professor Emerita at York University in Toronto, and I used to teach anthropology. Anthropologists are very interested in the way gender is constructed socially and culturally. In other words, it's not to say that biology isn't important, but it's very minimal in terms of what an anthropologist would look at. Anthropologists are, when they study gender, when they study sexuality, they look at the way cultures would consider maleness or femaleness and how that is made rather than how that is born. So in many senses, what is considered feminine in one culture would be not considered feminine in another culture. Masculine in one culture would not be considered masculine in another culture. Sexuality and gender are very flexible concepts, and they are in almost every society. In our own society, they're becoming more and more flexible. Now, one of the ways that, if you look at traditional societies, for instance, in societies where warfare was important, for example, you get a lot more stress on maleness, because females were much more they weren't as expendable because they were the ones that were reproducing. So you can't send females into war. They would be the ones that would be staying home, and males would go out and do the war, because survival meant having babies. In some cultures, there aren't only two genders. But then there's also the issue of, okay, what do you do? Somebody has an ultrasound, and they think that they're having a male or a female. So they go to paint the nursery. And the nursery could be pink, if it's a girl, generally, or it could be blue if it's a boy. And so this imagined sexuality, or imagined gender, happens very, very early. The child is born and is treated as such. You know, let's say there's a penis or a vagina, it's very clear, you know, what this child is going to be. And then expectations around that happen with toys, or expectations are reinforced with regard to toys and clothes and etc. So here's where the social molding comes in into the picture. You know, and the social, so as anthropologists, we're less interested in the biological aspects of sexuality than how that sexuality is expressed through cultural expectations. It's a fascinating issue, because in our own societies, you know, we're given permission today to be more flexible sexually. People, let's say 20, 30 years ago, would be frightened of saying, you know, I don't think I'm really this is not really me, and I need to do something. Well, today, I mean, you can make a choice. You know, you can cross-dress, you can have sexual surgery, you can be bisexual, you can be asexual. There's lots of opportunities. And I think that partly is because, you know, it's not an issue of survival anymore. But again, it's not the biological sex that's important. It's the cultural expectations, social expectations that's important. I'm very, very bothered by the stress on biology. I'm very, very bothered in biologizing, because every time we try to biologize, it has been very negative. You know, to say, well, this person is biologically suited to this or whatever. It's so restrictive because the fact is our biologies don't restrict us. Our biologies are maybe a baseline which can then be played with. And also the other thing is culture itself affects our biology. How we conceive of biology will impact on the way we look. In other words, our expectations and our notions of femininity or masculinity impact on the way we look, and in fact can shape our bodies. But I think the analyses today are so much more sophisticated because they're looking for cognitive cues on, you know, how people begin to think about themselves and their bodies. You know, it's just a much more sophisticated kind of perception of gender and sexuality. A much more flexible conception of gender and sexuality. And I don't think that biology plays a very strong role. We know that there's a vast array of possibilities within a society as well as between societies. And so that's what we need to look at. We need to look at this vast array of possibilities. I think what's important is the difference between the social, cultural aspects and the biological aspects. These are where the real divisions lie. And this is where you'd find a big difference between, let's say, if you were, you know, talking to a biologist or a psychologist, would talk to you about the psyche or a different, you know, like there are books written on men are from Mars, women are from Venus. You know, this is about the psyche, psychological, the difference in the brains, for example. You would never find anthropologists who are interested in social and cultural issues talking about the brain, except in the way that the social formation, structures, and culture are impacting on the brain. The brain is never leading anything. The brain is a responder. Bodies are responders. Now, you talk to psychologists and biologists, they're going to tell you the opposite. Our model for our children was always, you know, a very egalitarian model. So we never questioned it and questioned their choices around femininity, masculinity.
I'm Coleman Romalis, and I'm a retired professor from York University in Toronto. You know, I don't want to talk too much autobiographically, but in my life, I've always been very oriented towards girls and women. And I don't remember a period of sexual indecisiveness in my identity. But when I was young, and I have pictures of this, I loved putting on a dress of my mother's and putting on makeup and so on, and waltzing around and having my brother, my older brother, take pictures of me and walk down the street and let my mother's friends see how I could dress up so pretty. But it was not with any confusion that I can recall. And when I told friends about this, both of whom were psychoanalysts, they were shocked. And they thought that I had something that needed to be explored over the years. and my own reaction to that, too, was I was both mystified and shocked by the strength of their reaction. How somebody could, these are close friends of ours, how they could be so locked into very explicit ideas of what constitutes masculinity or femininity.
And when Liam was, our son, was one Halloween, he dressed up as Olivia Newton-John, and he thought that was real fun. I have a lot of hopefulness in terms of, you know, gender flexibility in the future. And I think it's going to be in those terms, a much better world for a lot of people who don't buy into the conservative perception of or religious perception because it allows so many people who kept themselves in the closet about different kinds of needs that would now not feel so bound by it.
Five Unexpected Gender Differences in Children's Clothing by Catherine D.M. Clover. Everyone knows that there are glaring differences between girls' and boys' clothes. It is no secret. Stores keep them in different sections, after all. As a feminist and a queer person, I have spent a lot of time thinking about gender inequalities for both adults and children. As my son and I have entered the world of kid clothes together, I am continually surprised by how heavily gendered it all is, and the weird way it manifests. Difference number one. The clothes fit differently, even in the same size. This was the first thing I noticed that really threw me for a loop. The clothing was heavily gendered, but it was the same stuff underneath. In other words, while each brand offered its usual pinks and blues, a six-month onesie was still a six-month onesie. Sure, one had an airplane on it and the other had a kid wearing a leopard print dress. Who comes up with this stuff? And the girl's option might also feature weird ruffles around the sleeves, but that was it. I could say, my kid is wearing 12-month clothes right now, and that would remain true whether we were talking about girls' clothes or boys' clothes. But at some point, that stopped being the case. Once you reach a certain size, many brands of clothing intended for boys and the same clothing intended for girls are wildly different sizes. These days, my child wears a 2T in Old Navy boys, but if you want to get anything from the girls' section, he loves sparkles, so we sometimes do, you're better off choosing a 3T. Now, I know what you're about to say. Little boys are often a bit bigger than little girls. This would make total sense to me if it weren't for the fact that the size charts don't reflect it. I've checked them. According to the data feeding US size charts, 2T should be the same thing regardless of which gender we're talking about, both pounds and height. The clothing companies disagree.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kate Gapinski. I'm a clinical psychologist and adjunct faculty member at the University of San Francisco, where I teach classes on gender and sexuality. The first piece of information we seem to process is whether the individual is male or female. It is part of the process of stereotyping. We're taking in a lot of information at any given time, and we're trying to be efficient about the processing of that. So in our culture, we find gender to be important, perhaps for a variety of reasons, for mating preferences, for signals of danger or safety, for any kind of social exchange that we might be looking to have. It can be thwarting to encounter someone whose gender is ambiguous. It thwarts the process of stereotyping. And we find that all of a sudden, we may not know how to deal with the individual in front of us because we can't go into those stereotyped roles of this is how I interface with a female, this is what I think I know about males, unless this is part of your community and you're more familiar with the experience. There is a spectrum of gender nonconformity in children. So sometimes there is a preference for cross-gender play, for example, and that's even relatively common. If it is extreme, where the child rejects all same-gender play or almost so and completely identifies, there's some research that suggests the child has a higher chance of being gay in adulthood, so having a same-sex sexual orientation eventually. Some children, in much rarer cases, end up having gender dysphoria, either in childhood or in adolescence. And so these kids have, it's not only a preference for cross-gender activities, it is a gender identity of being other than what the biological sex is. So we've seen cases of that in the media, of course, Jazz Jennings being one of the most famous, and she was someone who knew by age two that she was a girl trapped in a boy's body and has held that consistently through her teenage years. Gender identity is rarely changeable through the lifespan, but certainly in the case of some people, it is, whether a person is a transgender individual, eventually a transsexual individual, or someone who identifies as genderqueer, which sometimes means that you identify either with characteristics of both genders or sort of with neither gender exactly, sort of a third group. For most people, gender is a stable characteristic, and children understand by somewhere between age 3 and 6, that gender is likely to remain consistent across the lifetime, and that acting in gender atypical ways will not change your gender. So if a girl cuts her hair short, she's still a girl. Kids start to understand at this age. Or if a boy wears barrettes, that does not mean he is a girl. He's still a boy. For female children, there is more gender flexibility. So it is okay to be a tomboy, and one is allowed to sort of explore and maybe wear baseball caps and, you know, dirty jeans and tennis shoes. But boys are more discouraged from straying from the typical gender role. They're more constrained and even are bullied and discouraged by parents and peers, and perhaps even teachers in some settings. One interesting line of inquiry is how people relate to babies when they perceive them to be male or female. So several studies have been done where a child is dressed in, the same child is dressed in sort of either blue or pink, and strangers who are research participants come in and interact with that child. And people's assumption that the child is a boy actually makes them describe the same child differently than when they assume the child to be a girl. So they'll say, oh, he's so robust, he's so strong and burly. And they interface with him more roughly, you know, not aggressively, of course, but they want to do some horseplay. And with the girl child, they're cuddling her and cradling her and talking about how dainty and pretty she is. So this is the exact same baby, and people approach the situation differently based on their assumptions of gender, actually perceiving the child differently and interacting with that child in varied ways. Some other interesting research is that babies as young as 7 to 12 months can distinguish male from female faces. This is comes from the research of Fago and Lineback. And the way that researchers can determine this is looking at how long an infant studies a novel picture. So infants show what they think or what they understand by their attention to a stimulus, if that makes sense. So even as early as 7 to 12 months, there's some reliability in the baby demonstrating, oh, I'm seeing a female face, oh, whoa, that's a male face, that's different. And also, children under 6 months old may even be able to show a preference for female faces, because generally females are the caregivers. So even faces of females who are not that infant's caregiver may be preferred over the face of an unknown male, even as even under 6 months old. That's Ramsey Reynolds and Langua. Other interesting research, by 12 to 24 months, kids develop an awareness of gender-typical activities. So these little toddlers are seeing behavior that is gender inconsistent as surprising, and they pay more attention to it. When they see a male doing something that they feel like it's more likely that a woman would do, or vice versa, they perk up and they seem to find it surprising, so to speak. They attend to it. So even as young as 12 to 24 months, it's the research of Serban and colleagues. Then, by age 24 months, about 67% of kids are correct in their ability to label gender. So they are able to see, for the most part, accurately who seems to be identified as a female and who seems to be identified as a male. I think there are some innate gender differences. And I also think that is true for people who have a gender identity that is inconsistent with biological sex. There are some indications that they may be more neurologically similar in some ways to the gender identity that they hold rather than to the biological sex to which they've been assigned. There is some evidence of this in very sad cases, like a case study of a child whose penis was destroyed in a circumcision accident. And the boy never felt like a girl, even though he was raised as a girl. And he had a lot of psychological problems as a result of this harmful experiment of gender reassignment based on the loss of a penis. So it is not a penis, the absence or presence of a penis, that makes someone male, we conclude from unfortunate experiences like this one. There was a family in Canada who tried to not reveal the sex of their baby, and people were hostile and aggressive toward this family. They were enraged that they felt like the family was incredibly destructive to not be willing to label the child as male or female. Some people thought, well, how interesting, and this makes us all think in a different way. But then there were also folks who just had incredible antagonism toward the idea that we wouldn't automatically force our children into boxes based on male or female identity. So children who tend to exhibit more flexible attitudes about gender tend to be female, tend to be older children, adolescents, or young adults, tend to actually interact less with their parents, yet have parents who question traditional attitudes concerning gender-related behaviors. They also tend to have mothers who work outside the home and